This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
If no, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
Shocking and unacceptable. That is how Australia's Foreign Minister Penny Wong has described the actions of an Israeli minister mocking a group of activists Israel had detained. Now, the group is part of a flotilla trying to reach Gaza and includes 11 Australians. So what happens now? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're getting into this story, which has prompted Australia to demand a chat with Israel's ambassador. We're going to fill you in on all the details soon. Then later, our long listen of the week, we're speaking with human rights lawyer and UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese. Now, she's both celebrated and condemned around the world. The US even put sanctions on her last year. Those sanctions were lifted in the past day, so we're going to hear about that.
There should have been an upheaval, including in the US, among scholars, among legal experts.
Yeah, that chat with Francesca Albanese coming up later. First, though, let's talk a bit of AI courtroom drama.
Hack.
So that was quick.
Elon Musk just took a huge loss.
But he probably won in the court of public opinion.
Elon Musk sued OpenAI for, quote, stealing a charity.
Asking for $150 billion in damages.
At the heart of this case, whether Altman betrayed OpenAI's founding promise to build the company for the benefit of all humanity.
Triple J. Yeah, let's get an update on a case which has been making a lot of headlines this week, and it was always going to happen. This case, huge personalities involved. It's been called hilarious, worrying, cringy even. Two of the world's richest people beefing in front of a jury. On one side, Elon Musk. On the other, Sam Altman from OpenAI. Now, Musk accused Sam Altman of stealing a charity, effectively taking his money and using it to make more rather than helping humanity as he promised in the beginning. Both of these men had their reputations questioned, their motives questioned, the intentions of AI companies interrogated. And then the verdict came through. Elon Musk lost. I'm wondering, were you watching this? What did you think of it all? Did you think this case exposed the tech giants, as some are saying? And do you reckon it could change the way AI companies might operate? Message in 0439 757 555. Let's get an update now with Cam Wilson, who's the ABC's national AI reporter. G'day, Cam. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, good to be here.
What a week to be an AI reporter, can I say?
I feel like that is a kind of common occurrence. I think you're going to be saying that every week.
Probably, actually. You're not short of any stories. Yes. I mean, one of the big things that has been popping off this week, as I said, is this court case between the world's richest person, Elon Musk, and then on the other side, you've got OpenAI, Sam Altman. Can you tell us what that was about?
Yeah, so the crux of this case goes back to when Elon Musk was actually one of the co-founders of OpenAI, along with Sam Altman, back in the mid-2010s. He left the organization after a bit of a stoush while it was still a non-profit. But in the years since, two things have happened. One, it's become one of the biggest companies in the world. You know, it released ChatGPT at the end of 2022, which quickly became, the fastest growing consumer product. Everyone knows it. It's a kind of household name now. And the second thing is that it has transitioned from being a non-profit into a public good corporation, but a company that can kind of make money. And they want to make a lot of money. And Elon Musk is saying, wait a second, I invested all this money in initially thinking it was a non-profit, and all of a sudden you're using that money to make money. And I don't think that's fair.
It got pretty personal at some points. I mean, Altman was questioned about whether he was a liar, and Elon Musk's lawyers were saying he couldn't deny that he was a liar. I don't know. It's what ended up happening in the end.
So what happened in the end was actually the trial ended up ending on essentially like an administrative thing, which is that the statute of limitations, which in the legal system, Australia has it, the US has it, says that essentially you can't bring certain cases a certain amount of time after the incident happened as a way of being able to properly defend things that have happened, etc. In this case, the precipitating factor, I think, was that they set it back to 2018. So they looked at this, they had this long trial that went for 3 weeks. It had some of these, the most most powerful men, mostly men, in the world in court in a kind of a situation they're not used to having to answer tough questions. And despite all of that and all the, you know, juicy little bits we found out, it kind of ended essentially in a technicality. No, you can't know that this accusation that Elon Musk was saying, you know, these people stole a nonprofit. No, they didn't improperly do anything, or at least the law hasn't determined that because it was too long ago for us to rule on.
Yeah, well, Elon Musk was trying to make this argument that they'd strayed from their initial purpose, OpenAI, that it was supposed to be, you know, all about helping humanity, and now it was just a business operation. I mean, does this court case, do you think, Cam, tell us anything more about the AI industry, or has it basically vindicated the AI industry that they can just say, hey, we are a big business now and we can go out and make as much money as we want?
Well, look, you know, I don't know if anyone can vindicate them. That's not up to me. But I do think one of the fascinating things about this is that, you know, tech in particular is this industry that is so concentrated. A few people have so much power. And in particular, AI out of all tech is about this idea that there is this technology that is developing so quickly. And, you know, essentially, we are trying to build a digital god, and we're trying to make something even more powerful than humans. And as part of all of our attempts to build it, you know, me, whoever's running whichever company, should be the person that you trust to do this. And this case, to me, revealed all the ways in which these people out there who are incredibly powerful have control of these incredibly powerful systems, demonstrated their certain characteristics behind the scenes through things like texts and emails are revealed, you know, their testimony in court, that I think they came across sometimes as petty, as competing for power, and less kind of altruistic than they might wish to project.
Yeah, this court case has revealed all. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Cam Wilson, who's the ABC's national AI reporter, and we're talking about some of the big stories that have popped up regarding AI this week, because there have been a few. And one of the headlines, Cam, that grabbed my attention today was an MP, the Assistant Productivity Minister, actually, Andrew Lee, who is talking today about the realities of human extinction in the next 100 years. And surprise, surprise, AI features in this. He brings it up as a possible scenario. What's he saying there?
Yeah, so Andrew Lee, who is one of the quite iconoclastic federal politicians, you know, he spends his spare time, of which I just doesn't seem to have like a lot as a politician, but seems to find a lot of time to write papers, publish books. But one of the things that he's been really interested in recently is AI, and particularly looking at some of these long-term risks. You know, this is a thing that has been a kind of fascination of economists and also people in the tech industry for like 20 or 30 years, the real science fiction stuff about, like, you know, what happens if we do make this computer, this thing that actually is really intelligent, and then it decides it wants to do these other things? Or what if we make this technology that's so powerful that in the hands of some people, they could use it to do great harm? And in this speech, Andrew Lee is trying to reckon with this because, you know, I think it's kind of human nature just to really not think too much about the worst case scenario things. Like, I mean, look, you know, we all think about, you know, kind of awkward interactions we've had with people. You know, you think that all the time when you're going to sleep. But in terms of the real, like, long tail risks, the idea that AI could be used, for example, to create synthetic biological weapons that could wipe out the human race, I mean, personally, I tend to put it a little bit in the too hard basket. But, you know, Andrew Lee is saying that, hey, these are things that we do need to consider, because the point is that even if it is a very small chance of happening, potential risk or the cost in, you know, economic terms would be so great that it would be irresponsible not to take it very seriously.
Do you think it's unusual to hear this from a government MP, considering the government is often criticised for not doing enough to put in stricter safeguards around AI?
Well, look, I mean, I think, you know, one case you could say is that you want the government to be considering these far-off scenarios. And obviously, Andrew Lee is just one member of the government. And the government has, particularly over the last year or so, been doing more about AI safety. In fact, there is this National AI Safety Institute launching in the middle of this year. So it is kind of like the yin and yang of AI stuff, where, you know, people all the time say it has this incredible capacity. It will, you know, get rid of drudgery. It will improve our productivity, all the good things. But the flip side of that is, what if it's used wrong? What if it causes harms? And for many people, we already are aware of the harms that are happening right now. You know, deep fakes, misinformation, AI slop that just fills up your feeds. These things are all happening right now. And the AI community traditionally has thought about this a lot, and no doubt Andrew Lee is kind of weighing in too.
Look, it's so interesting, and obviously so much more to come out of these stories. But thank you very much for bringing us up to date. ABC National AI reporter Cam Wilson, appreciate you coming on Hack.
Thanks for having me.
And a lot of messages, someone saying the richest man in the world with the funds to fix so many of the world's problems, pretending to be altruistic by suing over control for even more money. Hypocrite, that person says. Someone else saying two little boys arguing over what is essentially nothing compared to their wealth. Interesting. Another person on the text line saying, I'm glad this case is happening because AI in general is negative for humanity. It is funny, though, that Elon is the one pursuing it. And someone else saying, digital god, geez, got a chill down my spine. All right, we're going to move on to the big story of the day.
Hack. Described as shocking, detainees in Israel who arrive on a flotilla, forced to their knees, zip-tied and then taunted.
On Triple J.
Yeah, Australia's relationship with Israel is in the spotlight today, with our government condemning the actions of an Israeli government minister for taunting activists. Now, video of this incident shows the activists, who were detained while on board a flotilla trying to get to Gaza, kneeling on the ground with their hands zip-tied behind their backs. Among the detainees, 11 Australians. So the government here, along with other governments from around the world, has called the behaviour out. We had Foreign Minister Penny Wong saying it's shocking and unacceptable and ordering Israel's ambassador to explain. Jackson Worthington has the latest.
Last night, Israel's far-right Minister for National Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, posted a video to X appearing to taunt detainees from the Global Samud Flotilla. The video shows the activists kneeling with their hands zip-tied behind their back and their faces on the ground. The minister is heard yelling things like, "Welcome to Israel, we are landlords, and long live the people of Israel." And in a separate video, he appealed to Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, for permission to keep the detainees in prison.
They came with much pride as big heroes. Look, see how they look now. Look, look at how they look now. Not heroes and not anything, terror supporters.
Activists from the Global Samud Flotilla have been in Israeli detention since Monday when their boats were intercepted in international waters. The flotilla set sail from Turkey last week with the hopes of breaking Israel's blockade of Gaza and creating a humanitarian corridor. Susie O'Toole's 23-year-old daughter Gemma was one of the 11 Australians on board. She told ABC Melbourne yesterday that she hadn't heard from her daughter since her vessel was intercepted.
Look, as a mother, I'm absolutely terrified of her safety.
Leaders from across the world have condemned the treatment of the activists. The United Nations has urged Israel to treat detainees with respect and return them to their home countries, while Treasurer Jim Chalmers says the videos are shocking.
There's absolutely no need or no place for it. You know, when it comes to people who are engaged in that journey, obviously our departments tried to discourage people from going down that path. But having gone down that path, they should be treated humanely. You know, I can only imagine what it's like to be a parent or a loved one of one of the people involved in that trip.
Israel's ambassador to Australia, Hillel Newman, was called in by the government to answer questions over the video. Speaking to reporters, he said his country could not be judged over the actions of one man.
No one was harmed. Ben-Gvir came in, humiliated them. This has been condemned from world to war, and the leadership of the state of Israel. He does not reflect the values of the state of Israel. He has been condemned by the prime minister, by the foreign minister, the entire leadership of the state of Israel. A country is not measured by the actions of one politician, but how the government responds to actions which are disgraceful. So we should put Ben-Gvir aside and address the real issue, which is the flotilla itself and what are the motivations behind the flotilla.
The Global Samud Flotilla and its supporters have repeatedly denied that they are terrorist sympathisers. The flotilla isn't the only big news out of the Middle East in the past few weeks. On Wednesday last week, a report from an Israeli not-for-profit detailed alleged instances of sexual assault against victims of Hamas's October 7 terror attacks. The report by the Civil Commission, which was founded in the wake of October 7, accuses the militant group of systemically and deliberately using sexual assault to maximise pain and psychological devastation. And a separate report released by the Board of Peace, which was established by US President Donald Trump and tasked with overseeing the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel, found the principal obstacle to a full ceasefire was Hamas's refusal to disarm. That report is expected to be discussed by the UN Security Council this week, with Hamas rejecting its findings.
Instead of visiting graves, I visit a home that is full of memories.
There have also been reports this week that thousands of bodies of Palestinians killed in Israeli strikes are still buried under rubble. 28 members of 23-year-old Lena's family were killed when Israeli bombs hit her building in 2024. She told the ABC many of their bodies are still under the rubble.
Each time I look at the house, I have regret. A pain. Why is it that I, after 2 years and 2 months, I have not succeeded in taking them out of the rubble?
In February, the United Nations estimated just 0.5% of the rubble in Gaza had been removed from the strip. The Civil Defence Service estimates 8,000 Palestinians are still buried beneath it. Israel blocks some supplies from entering Gaza because it says they can be taken and used by Hamas. The ABC contacted the government for comment but did not hear back.
Anna Kelly.
I'm only asking for one thing. Get my family from under the rubble so I can bury them, because the honour of the dead is with burial.
Hack on Triple J.
Jackson Worthington reporting there. All right, we're going to move on to our long listen of the week. And actually this week it is someone connected to Gaza.
You're listening to Hack.
Germany and the Czech Republic also joined France in calling for her removal as UN Special Rapporteur after the doctored video saga.
On Triple J.
What's it like to be both celebrated and condemned at the same time? To be held up as an inspiration by some and accused of hate by others? Well, this week's guest has a very strong idea, because over the past few years, she's dealt with this on a global scale. Francesca Albanese is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, and her job is to investigate, monitor, report on human rights. But over the past few years, while she's been speaking about Gaza, she has often become the headline. She was one of the first people to accuse Israel of genocide in Gaza, an allegation Israel denies. Israel has accused her of anti-Semitism, which is an allegation Ms. Albanese denies. She became the first UN official in history to be sanctioned by the United States. And not many people get that kind of punishment. She shares that with Vladimir Putin, Bashar al-Assad, Nicolas Maduro. But those sanctions have now been lifted after a judge in the US said Francesca Albanese had done nothing more than speak. Well, she's got a book out. It's called When the World Sleeps, and she's with us now to talk about it. Francesca Albanese, thank you so much for joining us on Hack. Firstly, I just want to ask you, a judge said these sanctions that the US imposed on you last year violated your human rights. He ordered they be blocked. How do you feel?
I feel relieved. And at the same time, I know that for me, for the way I am, this is not over, because this has never been only a personal battle. There are ICC prosecutors in the same situation I am. They've been sanctioned for doing exactly their job. I'm so grateful to my family to have convinced me as well that and supported me, because it was very onerous, and all the friends who have supported us to believe in justice.
I mean, you write about the impacts of the sanctions in your book, and you say you were the first UN official in history to receive such a sanction, which technically, I mean, prohibits your daughter, an American citizen, from engaging with you. What kind of impact has that had on your life?
The sanctions mean that no US person can provide any good and service, lest facing 20 years in jail and fines up to $1 million. So had my family members decided to observe strictly this regime, I would have been screwed for real. Mm. So I've counted on the solidarity of my family. And the other thing is that the chilling effect of the sanctions has been phenomenal. What I didn't appreciate was the silence of so many. There should have been an upheaval, including in the US, among scholars, among legal experts. And there has been in some quarters, but there's been also a lot of partisanship.
Francesca Albanese, you've spent your time in your role as Special Rapporteur deflecting attention away from your story and your life and focusing it on Palestinians, on Gaza, on the West Bank. But there is a lot of interest in you as a person, especially with young people around the world, I think. There are a lot of people that look up to you as a person. And in this book, you offer some insight into your life. What have the past couple of years been like for you personally? You've been scared or you've wanted to give up?
Of course, I'm always scared. I'm always scared. I see how this system works. And at the same time, you know, I often think, and this book was written for, especially young people who need to believe in justice, who need to understand that by sticking together, by supporting each other for what is just, they can make it. And the solidarity is an absolute value that I believe in. Yeah, I said in the beginning, I was surprised. I mean, I would have appreciated more courage by people with a position, with a public voice. But at the same time, I've seen so many coming forward from all corners to stand by me.
Francesca, you've copped a lot of criticism over these past few years, even over the past few months. France's foreign minister accused you of targeting Israel as a people and as a nation, saying that you called Israel the common enemy of humanity. You did not say that. And groups like Amnesty International condemned European officials for claiming that you did. I am wondering, though, what is it like being constantly accused of hatred and accused of anti-Semitism?
It is not nice, and I will get back to it. But I also want to point to something. So the Minister of Foreign Affairs of France, he said something, he accused me for something that I never said. This is so preposterous and so arrogant. And again, I'm very happy to have seen, yeah, in France, a lot of reaction from the media, from the legal community, from civil society, even people who wouldn't necessarily speak out on issues concerning Palestine. I've been appalled by this. And we should talk of these toxicity in politics. They are not held accountable and they keep going. Going back to the other part of your question, it's awful. It's been awful to be accused of anti-Semitism until the moment I realized what the accusation means. Today, anti-Semitism, which is still alive and kicking, but anti-Semitism doesn't mean anymore in some circles what it means, meaning hatred against Semite people or Jewish people. Today, anti-Semitism is conceived by some as indisposition or criticism of the state of Israel, as if Israel, for some reason, for its proclaimed religion, could be above the law. Does it not deserve scrutiny? So, yeah, I mean, it still pains me to be associated by some to anti-Semitism, but I've been surrounded by so many Jewish organizations and Jewish scholars themselves and Israelis who say, keep doing what we're doing.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with UN Special Rapporteur and human rights lawyer Francesca Albanese. She's written a book. It's called When the World Sleeps, and it's just been released in English. She originally wrote it in Italian, but now it's been translated. Francesca, this book is described as stories, words, and wounds of Palestine. Why did you decide you wanted to write a book?
Yeah, first of all, this book has been really cathartic for me to write because there are two things. On the one hand, I love the reports I managed to write. However, it's impossible to bring in reports that are 9,000 words long, the life and the human dimension that is behind these violations. So there was this need of telling a human story also because I've been such a privileged traveler across Palestine as someone who worked there as a UN official and then as a scholar. And the other thing is that it was very cathartic to write this book while I was carrying out the investigation on businesses involved in the occupation and in the economy of occupation, which turned into economy of genocide. And it was very consuming, and I felt completely exhausted by the kind of investigation, me and my team. I had a great team supporting me. But it was beautiful and rehumanizing to write that. I was very happy to see that people have loved it. They loved it. It became a bestseller.
You talk about impartiality, and I thought that was really interesting because you're constantly being accused of not being impartial or lacking impartiality.
Being impartial doesn't mean not recognizing the asymmetry of power between the two. So for me, impartiality is looking at the facts brought before me objectively, studying them, verifying them, corroborating them, which is something I absolutely do, and including by sharing all my findings with Israel. And Israel never replies, never replies. They only smear me once the reports have come out accusing me of anti-Semitism and supporting terrorism. Why don't they engage with me and correct what is factually wrong according to their assessment when they have an opportunity? And so, you see, impartiality is to look at the facts and, because I mean, as a legal expert, I have to use international law and assess them according to international law. This is what it is and this is what I do.
There's been a lot of talk, Francesca Albanese, about international law this year specifically, and some people have suggested it means nothing. What is the point of these international laws when it feels like this old order does mean very little, that we've entered this new era in the world where the rules are meaningless? What do you say to that?
That's so naive and defeatist. And I understand, but the question is, do you really believe, guys, that we lived in Wonderland? Have you seen how indigenous people live in your own country? Do you know in Australia the story of Aboriginal civilization because of colonialism and settler colonialism? No, we do not live in an ideal world. It's a very unequal and very unjust world. And today with Palestine, we find ourselves in front of a mirror. This is giving a sense of urge to change this and to fight for a more equal, more dignified, less double standard-led world. So the response to all these should be humanity, recognizing each other as part of a human family. And it's beyond rhetorical. Human rights are very important. Human rights are what allow us to protect ourselves in front, within a state, in front of the law.
Do you think the world is getting better or worse at understanding human rights?
I think it's getting better. This is why I've not been teaching in the past 2 years, but I've had a lot of many lectures. And in each I say, look, there is an awakening. And Gaza has ignited a sense of dismay.
A lot of people, a lot of young people, young Australians look up to you as a role model. I'm wondering, who do you look up to, Francesca Albanese?
Oh, so many young people. And then look at the Palestinians who remain loving and kind. They keep on thinking when Palestine will be free, which doesn't mean imagining the extinction of the Israelis. No, but living in a place where it doesn't matter if it's one state or two states, everyone live free.
A lot of young people do struggle with feeling hopeless about the state of the world. And I remember I spoke with you 1 year ago and you were very positive about not only the future for both Palestinians and Jewish people in the world, but humanity generally. What's your advice to those who are feeling unsure or unscared, those young people who are really uncertain about the world they're inheriting?
This is a time that is testing our capacity to stand together as humanity for a better world. It sounds rhetorical, but in fact, it has a very practical meaning and resonance. Together, we will make it. I promise. Trust me, I am someone who holds her promises.
Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur, thank you very much for speaking with us on Hack.
Bye-bye, everyone. Bye.
And yeah, if you want to hear the full interview with Francesca Albanese, it's up on the Hack podcast. You can go listen to that now. As I said, Francesca Albanese, a polarizing person on the text line. We can see that too. Someone saying, what a legend, heartful and courageous. But then someone else saying, I think Francesca Albanese distorts the truth and borders on being a liar, that person says. We've actually got Casper on the line with us. Casper, you met Francesca Albanese last year. How was that?
Hi there. Yeah, that's right. I was lucky enough to attend a speech by her in Rotterdam at the university, and it was just incredible. I'm an international law student, and she's a massive personal inspiration to me, and I truly believe she'll be remembered fondly by history. And it was just an amazing time. You know, she entered the room, and the entire crowd stood up. There's this applause, and there was this energy in the room of hope. and a solidarity. And yeah, she's just a massive inspiration to me, and it was incredible to meet her.
Kaspar, thank you so much for having a chat with us. That's really lovely to hear, and there are other people on the text line who are saying similar things to you. Someone saying, Francesca Albanese is the only Albanese that I respect right now, that person says, okay. And someone else saying she has more integrity, courage and a moral fortitude than a lot of our politicians. So yeah, look, definitely a lot of opinions on her, and the news that those sanctions that the US had placed on her when we recorded that interview, the judge in the US had said they should be blocked, but the US has lifted those sanctions now. And, you know, she's celebrating that after a year of living under those conditions and those rules. All right, that is all we've got time for on Hack for now.